Okay, morning. It's Parshas Pekudei, page 530. Parshas Pekudei is an interesting parasha. It's not often that it's read separately as an independent parasha. Normally it goes together with Vayakel. But being that it's a leap year, that's when they normally get separated out, and hence we have Parshas Pekudei. So, Parshas Pekudei essentially is the culmination and the end of the whole process of building the Mishkan. We know that, as we said before, Truma Tetzaveh was when Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu about the Mishkan. Vayakel Pekudei is when Moshe Rabbeinu commands the Jewish people. And then finally, in this parasha, it's the whole end. Everything was done. Everything was put in place. Everything was fixed. And was the whole process of building the Mishkan in the desert was completed. So we'll do the first few psukim of Pekudei, again, page 530. What happened at the beginning of the parasha is that Moshe Rabbeinu instructed that an audit should take place, a very careful audit of exactly what all the materials were that came in for the Mishkan, and where it went, and what was used for what. So let's just read a few psukim, and then we'll see an interesting idea that comes out of this all. So page 530 says the pasuk, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan. This is the reckonings, the counting of the Mishkan, the audit, in other words, the counting of everything. Then the pasuk calls it Mishkan Ha'edus, the Mishkan of Testimony. Now, why is the Mishkan called Mishkan Ha'edus? Simply because the main object of the Mishkan was the Aron, the Ark, and the Aron is called previously in the Chumash Aron, the Edus, Luchos Edus, because it had the Luchos, the tablets, the Ten Commandments, which were testimony that Hashem rests His Shekhinah, rests His presence among the Jewish people. So that's why the pasuk over here refers to it as Mishkan Ha'edus. Now, it says the pasuk, Asher Pukad al Pi Moshe. This was counted. This was administered through by Moshe Rabbeinu's instruction. This order, this counting that they're about to do, was put into place by the command of Moshe Rabbeinu. Avoidas Halavim, but actually it wasn't Moshe Rabbeinu who actually did it. It was entrusted into the hands of the Levim, the Levites, who biyad Isamar ben Aaron HaKohen, who were led by Isamar, the son of Aaron HaKohen. Isamar was one of Aaron's sons. He was in charge of the Levim, because generally later we find that when the Mishkan used to move from one place to another, when it would go traveling and so on and so forth, there was a whole job that the Levim had to pack and unpack and reconstruct and dismantle, and so on and so on. So, and who's in charge of that? Isamar, one of the sons of Aaron. So this is what the pasuk means. It's a bit of a long-winded pasuk. The pasuk says this is the audit of the Mishkan. The Mishkan is called Mishkan Ha'edus. It was instructed by Moshe Rabbeinu. It was in the hands of the Levim, who were in turn in the hands of Isamar, the son of Aaron. Now, pasuk continues. Who provided the information for this audit? When you do an audit, you have to have someone providing the financial information. Says the pasuk, now continues. Says the pasuk, Betzalel ben Uri ben Chur lemata Yehuda. Betzalel, the son of Uri, the son of Chur, the tribe of Yehuda. He was one of the project managers of building the Mishkan, so to speak. Asa kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. He did whatever Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu to do in the Mishkan, he did. Then says the pasuk, Ve'itoyan, with him, we haven't come across him so often, but with him, he had a helper. Who was the helper? Aholiyav ben Achisomach, someone called Aholiyav, the son of Achisomach. Lemate Don, of the tribe of Don. Chorosh v'choshev, he was a craftsman. V'roikim, he was able to embroider. Batcheles of Argomon. Talas Hashani v'shesh, with the crimson wool, the red wool, and so on, and the linen. He was able to do that, and he helped Bezalel. Okay. Now, a couple of interesting things in this pesukim before we go on. What did I do with that paper? Wasn't that? A couple of interesting things, and that is that The pasuk over here says the word Mishkan twice. And we'll come back to it later, but what is it? Oh, it's like it says this is the audit of the Mishkan. Mishkan Ha'edus, right? The Mishkan of testimony. So Rashi points out, why does it say the word Mishkan twice? So Rashi says that the word Mishkan is a... The two words Mishkan is a remnant, it's a hint to the two temples that stood in Yerushalayim. The first temple and the second temple. Which the reason that they're called by the word Mishkan is the interesting thing Rashi says, because when they were destroyed, right, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash, so we know the Pshat is that they weren't really destroyed. In other words, they were taken by Hashem to be returned. So when we say the Mishkan was the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, ultimately when the temple was destroyed in Yerushalayim, it's as if Hashem had taken it back to hold as what we call a mashkoim. A mashkoim means a collateral, like a guarantee. Hashem will give it back. It's like when you take, when you lend someone money, you take a mashkan. It means you take a collateral, a guarantee, right? So therefore, the reason that the Beis HaMikdash is called Mishkan, Mishkan means a tabernacle, a sanctuary, a place of the divine Shekhinah, but also means a mashkan, a collateral. So therefore, the reason why it says Mishkan twice in the Chumash is because it refers to the two Bat HaMikdash, the two temples, which is Mishkan, 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 Mishkan HaEdus, which was the two temples which were taken as a bashkan, they were taken as a collateral by Hashem when they were destroyed. Interesting, I just saw someone show me this morning, and I've left the paper downstairs, but I'll try and remember it, that apparently it's got to do with the gematria also. Interesting, the gematria of the word Mishkan is 410, and 410 is the number of years that the first Beis HaMikdash stood, right? Ham Mishkan has an extra hey, but in gematria you can also do different things. So when you take the word Hamishkan, first you have an extra hey, which is an extra five. Plus you can use the five letters of the word Hamishkan. And then it's an extra five again, so that's 420, which is the number of years the second Beis HaMikdash stood. So when the pasuk says, Eile Pekudei Hamishkan Mishkan Ha'edus, that's another remez, another hint to the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash. Hamishkan being the second Beis HaMikdash because it stood for 420 years. Mishkan meaning the first Beis HaMikdash, which stood for 410 years. Some of them did. The Oren did. The Menorah did. The Kalim of the Mishkan were hidden. In fact, the whole Mishkan was. It says that the day Moshe Nitzchim, that whatever Moshe Rabbeinu did was internal, which is, by the way, one of the reasons that Moshe Rabbeinu never went into Eretz Yisrael. Because actually, it ended up being a favor for the Yidden. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu would have gone to Eretz Yisrael and built the Beis HaMikdash, that Beis HaMikdash would have never been able to be destroyed. And Hashem would have had to take out his anger on the Yidden. And it was actually a tova for the Yidden, because it says... The Gemara says there's a chapter in Tehillim where it says Mizmor LaOsof, Kapitel Ein Tes, chapter 79 in Tehillim, which says a song for Osof, and the Tehillim describes the whole destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara asks, Mizmor LaOsof? You call it a Mizmor, a song? Kino, it's a lamentation, not a song. So the Gemara says, no, it's actually a favor. That the fact that the Eibishter destroyed the Beis HaMikdash is actually a toiver for the Yidden, because he poured out his anger on the wood and on the stones. Right, which is an interesting thing. So getting back to your question, therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, so whatever he made was eternal and still exists, but just a lot of it, most of it is hidden. The Aron went with them. The Aron went and became part of the first Beis HaMikdash, and then was also hidden.
Sorry? I heard that it's under the tunnel.
That's the Aron. The Aron is under the tunnel. I don't know about all the Kalim. I'm not sure about all the Kalim. Could be. I don't know. Could be. Okay. The Kli Yakar brings a medrash, or the Kli Yakar brings a chazal. But the reason it says two times the word Mishkan is because they're always, whenever we build a Beis HaMikdash, there are two Bat HaMikdash, there are two levels of the Beis HaMikdash. It's what we call the Beis HaMikdash Shelemaila. There's the heavenly Beis HaMikdash and the earthly Beis HaMikdash. In other words, there's the Beis HaMikdash, which is down here. But I think I mentioned this last week, but the Beis HaMikdash down here corresponds to a Beis HaMikdash which is up there. There's a spiritual Beis HaMikdash that resides in heaven, and they correspond and they correlate with each other, so to speak. And that's why it also says the word Mishkan twice. Okay, now, let's have a look what actually happens with this. Oh, sorry, one point before we go on. Just something that has nothing to do with really when we're going to the Shia. Just, I thought I'd just mention it. It's an interesting Rashi. And it needs its own discussion, but I'm not going to go into it now. But it's when we mentioned Bezalel, who was the project manager of the Mishkan, it says Bezalel did Chol Asher Tziva Hashem is Moshe, whatever Hashem commanded Moshe. Rashi points out, it doesn't say that Bezalel did everything Moshe told him, but it says he did whatever Hashem told Moshe. Because it's a very interesting thing that happened, that when Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem told him to build a Mishkan and then to build the Kelim, right? When Moshe Rabbeinu communicated, he told Bezalel first to build the Kelim, first to build the vessels, and then to build the walls. So Bezalel said, is it possible such a thing should happen? Is it possible that there should be Kelim without a house? Surely, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, you take it right, Hashem said it the other way around, and you should build the thing. So he ended up doing what Hashem had told Moshe, not so much what Moshe had told him. That's what Rashi says. Why that happened, and why Moshe Rabbeinu first said that, that's a whole other discussion. I think we've gone into another time, but we'll leave it for now. Okay, now, let's see what happens next. So we'll just read a few psukim, different ones. So, first of all, we start with the gold. So it says, Kol azov, all the gold, pasuch of dalit. All the gold, he'osui lamlocha, b'chol melechas ha'kodesh. So first of all, the gold. It says, v'yihi zahav ha'tenufa. The gold that was donated was teisha ve'estrim kikar. There were 29 kikar. Kikar is a huge measurement of gold. U'shva me'oy s'shloshim shekel. And 730 shekel b'shekel ha'kodesh. Okay, then it goes to the silver, and it talks about, let's say, look, it says, v'kesev p'kud adam as kikar, there were 100 kikar of kesev, elo shama, it's chamish, v'shim, v'shek, v'shem, v'kodesh, a whole business. In other words, then it went, and it says, the silver, a lot of it was used to melt down, and was used for the sockets to hold the beams. Then, skip to Pasuk Chav Zayin. No, sorry. Go to Pasuk Chav Ches, sorry, next page, 532. Then it singles out one part of the silver and it says the following. It says, Veso elef ushva hameyos, 1,000 ushva meyos and 700 v'chamisha v'shivim, 775 shekel of silver. What do they do with that? Oso vovim lo amudim. They made the hooks for the pillars. I'll explain to you what that means in a second. V'tzipor roshayim, v'chishak oisam. They covered the tops and they made these hooks. They banded them and then they were the hooks on the pillars. What are the hooks that we're talking about? And why is it singled out? So the hooks we're talking about are like this. You know how the Mishkan was structured when they built the Mishkan? And I'll tell you why I'm going into it with such detail, because we'll see a whole concept behind this in a minute. So when they built the Mishkan, right, they built the inner sanctuary where the ark was hot and the menorah and the shulchan and all that. And that was, the walls over there were surrounded by beams, right? We had that in Parshas Truma. They built these huge beams, they bolted them together, they sat in sockets of silver, and that was the structure of the Mishkan. The rest was a courtyard. The courtyard was surrounded by beams, but not beams next to each other. In other words, the courtyard was not surrounded by a wooden wall, but it was beams that had spaces between them. On those beams, they put hooks, and on the hooks, they hung what we call hangings, kalei hechotzer, like curtains. And those curtains that hung on the hooks, which the hooks were attached to the beams, became the wall of the courtyard of the Mishkan. Clear? So in other words, you had, when you walked into the courtyard, you just saw a wall of curtain. Those curtains were attached to hooks, which were the beams. So the beams and the hooks were actually outside the courtyard. So Chazal tell us a very interesting thing about this audit that Moshe Rabbeinu administered. Hang on a second here, I'm just going to find it. Okay. There's a Medrash, right, that comments on this pasuk about the amount of silver that was used for the beams. And also in Zohar HaKadosh, in the Zohar, it talks about this whole audit that Moshe Rabbeinu did. Why did he do this audit? So one of the reasons is because there were, as in every generation, there were what we call the late Sonei HaDor, the scoffers of the generation. And the scoffers of the generation said, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu is a pretty wealthy guy by the looks of things, and probably it came from the donations that were given to the Mishkan. So in order, because we have a principle that a person should always be clean, not only by himself, but in the eyes of people, so to rid himself of any suspicion, Moshe Rabbeinu put in place a whole audit, so it should be completely transparent, and everyone should know exactly where everything went for the donations of the Mishkan. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't take anything for himself. One thing he did become rich from, interesting, there's a Rashi that when Moshe Rabbeinu was told, it's nothing to do with this topic, just an interesting thing, that Moshe Rabbeinu was told to carve out the second luchos. The first luchos was given by Hashem, that was that stone that came from heaven. But the second luchos, psal luchos, was actually taken from stone that Moshe Rabbeinu had to carve out. Where did he carve them out from? So it was made out of sapphire or some very, very expensive stone, which there was a mine in Moshe Rabbeinu's tent. Moshe Rabbeinu actually mined it in his own tent, and it says from the trimmings, when he carved it out from the leftovers, Hashir Moshe Rabbeinu became rich from that. Okay, that was something else. That was Hashem told him to do that. That was fine. But the donations of the Mishkan were public money that he didn't take for himself, Chas v'Shalom, and it was all for the Mishkan, didn't audit. But there's a Zohar, there's a Midrash that says that when it came actually to do the audit, something didn't fit, it didn't balance in the beginning. What happened was there was a certain amount of silver. This amount, this 1,775 shekel of silver that seemed to be extra that no one could account for, because Moshe Rabbeinu forgot what they were used for. Until it says he realized, that's why the pasuk isolates this. In this pasuk of Chesen says that the 1,775 shekelim of silver were used to make the hooks of the azara of the courtyard for the curtains to hang on. Okay, that's what it says. Now there's a very famous Kabbalah sefer called Megale Amukos. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him in a minute. I'll tell you a very fascinating story. And he says al pi Kabbalah, a fascinating thing. He extends the Medrash a bit for. Now I'll just tell you about Megale Amukos before I tell you what he says. And just because I came across this amazing story, so I'm going to just share it with you, even though it's nothing to do with the shir. It's a bit of a freaky story, so I hope you're okay with it. Megale Amukos was an unbelievable Mekubal who lived in Poland. He wrote on Chumash, he wrote an amazing thing. He was a very, very great tzaddik, a very great Mekubal. His name was Rav Nosson Nota Shapiro, 16th century, lived in Poland. In Krakow, he's buried in Krakow, and next to his grave, there's an unmarked grave, which has a matzeva, which has a stone there, and it has the following words. It says, "Here lies buried an unknown man, Yagid Olav Re'ehu," which means the pasuk, "Let his neighbor tell you about him." What's the story behind this grave? What happened was like this. The grave is next to the Megale Amukos. It's next to the Megale Amukos cave. What happened was as follows, that many, many years ago, a young person came to the shamish of the shul of the Chevra Kaddisha in Krakow, an unknown person, a very simple person, and he asked the shamus that there's a burial spot next to the Megale Amukos, and he wants to be buried there. When he dies, he wants to be buried there. So the shamus says, "What's your sugar? That's going to be reserved for a place, another big tzaddik maybe." And the guy wouldn't let him go, and he said, "No, I need to be buried next to Megale Amukos, and I'm ready to pay you an exorbitant amount of money." And the shamus kept on pushing him away, and then in a moment of weakness, apparently the shamus said, "Okay, how much are you ready to pay?" And the shamus figured this follow. At the time, the shamus was about 80 years old, and this guy was young. So he gave a very, very big price, and he said, "I'll pay you on the spot." And the shamus said, "Okay, give me the money." So he gave him the money, and the shamus took the money, which he shouldn't have, and forgot about it. What happened was, not long after that, this guy actually died. He died young, and the shamus was still alive. Shamus already forgotten about the whole story. The Chevra Kaddisha had no idea about the whole deal he made with the Shamus. The Chevra Kaddisha took the guy, they didn't know he was a regular guy, and they buried him in the regular cemetery wherever everyone else is buried. That night, the Shamus had a dream. This guy appears to the Shamus in a dream and says, "We made a deal. You need to fix this up. You have to bury me next to Megale Amukos." So he gets up, dream. He's not going to worry about the dream. Comes two or three times later, he has the same dream every night, and the third night, this guy comes to him and says, "Listen, if you're not going to do what I'm telling you, I'm going to call you to Din Torah, and I'm going to call you here to Din Torah." Right? So now he gets scared, so he runs to the Rav. And the Rav at the time was the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, a great man, the Bach. Bach doesn't know what to do. Okay. So the Bach tells him like this. He says, "Next time he comes to you in a dream, tell him that you want to go to Din Torah, but the Din Torah is going to happen here, in this world." It's a very, very spooky story. Okay, that's what happens. He has a dream. The guy comes to him and says, okay, we're calling it a din Torah in this world. So then he goes to the Bach's house. The Shammah goes to the Bach's house. And the Bach is ready for the din Torah. And he put up a curtain. And he starts the din Torah. And suddenly there's a voice from behind the curtain. And it's the voice of this guy who passed away. This is the story goes. The Bach says to him, who are you? He says, I can't tell you my name. He says, what do you want? He says, I made a deal that I would be buried next to Megala Mukais. And you need to keep my deal. The Bach says, but you need to tell us who you are. We need to know if you're deserving of being buried next to such an unbelievable tzaddik. Because Megala Mukais was known as an unbelievable makubal, a great tzaddik. And you know, next to a tzaddik has to be another tzaddik. You can't just... He says, no, I'm not allowed to tell you my name. Obviously, it was a hidden tzaddik. That was the idea. But they wouldn't tell the Bach who he was. The Bach says to him, listen, I can't tell you... if you can't tell me who you are, then we cannot... heed to your request. And then the Bach suddenly had an idea, and the Bach said to him, but the truth is like this, he said to him, if you're such an unbelievable tzaddik and you need to be buried next to the Megala Mukais, you can go and arrange it yourself. And that was the end of the interview. The next morning the Chevra Kadisha came to the cemetery in Krakow, and they found the grave of the guy empty, and there was a grave next to the Megala Mukais, and there was someone buried there. So they knew what to do. They put up a matzeva. Obviously they knew that this is something very special. They would have put up a matzeva, and they didn't know who the guy's name was. They had no idea. So they put on the inscription, Poi Nitman, over here, someone is buried, an unknown person. Yagid Olav Re'eyu, let his friend, obviously he was a friend of the Megala Mukais, and they were contemporaries, they were colleagues. He would tell him, like him, his friend should testify that he's a kosher. Anyway, that's a story, a famous story about the Megala Mukais. It's not actually about the Megala Mukais so much, about the Mukubu. Anyway, why am I bringing the Megala Mukais? The Megala Mukais brings this medrash. The Megala Mukais says the following statement. I'm going to share with you an unbelievable concept that I read in a book called the Munas Sitecha. I've quoted from before. Munas Sitecha is written by Rav Wolfson, who's today he's an old man already today. He's a Rav, a very, very big kahila. He's a Mashgiach and Torah Vadas. He's a very big... he writes amazing svarim. And he writes this amazingly wild pshat based on the Megala Mukais. The Megala Mukais says the following. Megala Mukais says that when Moshe Rabbeinu forgot what that extra silver was used for, and then suddenly he remembered that it was used for the hooks of the courtyard, says the Megala Mukais, what happened? He says what happened was that the neshama of Rabbi Akiva appeared to him, and because the neshama of Rabbi Akiva appeared to him, he was able to tell him where that extra money was used for. And that's when Moshe Rabbeinu knew that it was used for the hooks of the chatzar. Now, I want you just to note that in the pasuk, if you have a look in the pasuk, just have a look again, the pasuk Chaf Ches, it says that it was used for osa vovim la'amudin, they made vovim. There's many names for hooks, but the word for hooks used in the Mishkan is vovim, or in the single vov. Vov means a hook. Okay, and that's going to become significant in the middle. So he asks the question, and he says the Megala Mukais, and this has to do with the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is the source of Torah Shebichsav. Moshe Rabbeinu is the source of the written Torah, and Rabbi Akiva was the source of the oral Torah, and therefore Rabbi Akiva was able to reach places where Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't able to reach. That's what he says. So he asks the question. He says, "What does all this mean? First of all, what's the connection to Rabbi Akiva's neshama? Right, that he came in and he told Moshe Rabbeinu where those hooks for." Why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu remember in the beginning? Why did he need Rabbi Akiva to remind him? And what's it got to do with the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is the source of the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, and Rabbi Akiva was the source of the oral Torah? So you need to understand like this. He explains, I guess I'm going to try and sort of describe this whole concept. First of all, let's just talk a little bit about Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu. There's a very, very famous medrash that Moshe Rabbeinu was shown a vision of all the future generations. And that was the famous medrash where Moshe Rabbeinu questioned Hashem's justice, and he says, how could it be? He was shown Rabbi Akiva, and he was shown that Rabbi Akiva was going to be tortured, and then he asked Hashem, Zu Torah, Zu Schorah, is this the reward for Torah? And Hashem said, Shtoik, you have to be quiet, this is what I decided to do, you can't always question, you can't always understand, and so on and so forth. One of the things the medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu was shown a vision, he was shown a vision of Rabbi Akiva giving a shir. And he was teaching something that Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't know. And the Medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu had chalishus hadas. He felt bad. How could it be? He's the one that gave the Torah. Right? He doesn't know something. He doesn't know what Rabbi Akiva is teaching. He doesn't understand the shir. He doesn't know this halacha that Moshe Rabbeinu is teaching. When suddenly, and he felt he had chalishus hadas. when suddenly it says in the Medrash that he saw one of the Talmidim in the vision of Rabbi Akiva's shir. He saw one of the Talmidim asking Rabbi Akiva, "Rabbi, where do you know this from, this halacha?" To which Rabbi Akiva replied, "Halacha leMoshe miSinai. This is halacha that's been handed down from Moshe Rabbeinu from Sinai." And then Moshe Rabbeinu felt okay. What does all this mean? So we know like this. Sometimes Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu were totally two different individuals. Rabbi Akiva had a certain greatness that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have, yet that greatness came from Moshe Rabbeinu. It was inspired by Moshe Rabbeinu. What do I mean there were two different people? Let's have a look at who they were. Moshe Rabbeinu was a person who was born in absolute purity. When he was born, it says in the Pasuk, that Yocheved saw that he was good. And Rashi says, what does it mean they saw he was good? That when he was born, Nismale Habayis, the house became filled with light. Right? That's what it says, full of light. Moshe Rabbeinu was born with Kedusha. He was a born tzaddik. Completely. Mibetan umileda. From birth, he was a tzaddik. He was pure. He was holy. He was Noilad Mohol. They said he was born circumcised. He was complete Kedusha from the day. Which is why he became the person who could be the only Navi that could talk to Hashem face to face. He could be the person that had such a gilui, such a revelation of godliness, that he was able to talk to Hashem being up, completely with all his faculties, with absolute clarity. And he was able to receive the Torah face to face from Hashem and give it over to Klal Yisrael. But specifically because of that clarity, what Moshe Rabbeinu, so to speak, couldn't do, he couldn't take that Kedusha and make it descend to a very, very low level. Because he was such purity. Because he was such purity, there was a level of uncleanliness, a level of outside of Kedusha, a level that he's so detached from Kedusha that even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't reach because he had such purity. Who was able to reach that? Who was able to take it further? Who was able to take the Torah further? Just like the Torah Shabbat Peh takes the Torah Shabbat Chsav further. Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was an opposite person. Rabbi Akiva's father, Rabbi Akiva was born to his father, who was a convert, Judah, who didn't come from a line of tzaddikim, so to speak. The name Rabbi Akiva, what does the word Akiva mean? Akev. A heel. Rabbi Akiva himself was born a complete ignoramus. He didn't learn anything until he was 40 years old. We know the famous story. He was a boor. He was an empty person. Right? So much so that when he married his wife, his father-in-law disinherited his own wife, his own daughter. Because he was so upset that she fell for him, so to speak. Right? Rabbi Akiva afterwards went on to be Rabban Shel Kol Yisrael. He went on to be the greatest teacher of Kol Yisrael. The source of Torah Shabbat Peh, as we know it today. He was able to interpret all the crowns, the tagging on the Torah, to learn, says, mountains of halachas from each little nuance of Torah Shabbat Chsav. He was able to expand the Torah in ways that were unprecedented. But he was able also to go into such levels and to reveal such things that even Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't able to do. But only because he was connected to Moshe Rabbeinu. But what he did was, that's the meaning of the Medrash, that he taught something and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know, and he said it's halacha leMoshe miSinai, right? So he took it a step further. He was able to make it more reaching, far reaching, even more than Moshe Rabbeinu could. Now, what's it got to do with our whole topic? So he brings the interesting concept. He says, we know that the Yidden are divided into 12 tribes. I'm sharing with you this for because that's actually particular significance for this year. The Yidden are divided into 12 tribes. These 12 tribes, Yud Beis, have to do with the 12 permutations of Yud Kei Vav Kei. You know the name of Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei. We've talked about this many times. They have 12 ways. Yud Beis Sirufim, you can write it 12 different ways, right? Yud Kei Vav Kei, Vav Hei, Yud Hei, whatever, all different ways of writing Yud Kei Vav Kei. There's 12 permutations, 12 ways. Each month is connected to a different one. We know the 12 months, the 12 Shvatim. And that's where the Yidden come from. And therefore, and because of that, every Yid has an Hashem, every Yid has a soul. Every soul has a connection to one of the letters of the Torah. As it says, Shish Yisrael, the word Yisrael is an acronym for Yesh Shishim Ribui Oisies La Torah. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah, and each neshama is connected to another letter of the Torah. Okay. However, what happens is there are certain neshamas that get lost. There are certain neshamas that fall off the radar. He explains that where do they come from? Particularly, they come from the tribe of Don. Because it says And when the Yidden traveled, the Yehuda went in front, and there was 12 tribes that traveled in a straight line, and the last tribe to travel was Dan. They were the lowest tribe, and then some of the people got lost from Shevet Dan, so to speak. What that means, Beruchnis, is that certain neshamas get lost. And in fact, he brings it up, Pi Kabbalah, those neshamas also have a place in Torah, but the letters of Torah that they are written or connected to are from the last 8 psukim of the Torah. Because it says the last 8 psukim of the Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't write himself, according to some opinions. Yeshua wrote it afterwards. It wasn't even Moshe Rabbeinu's psukim, so to speak. These neshamas, unfortunately, are always, a Yid always has a neshama. But sometimes you have a neshama that, for whatever reason, is lost. Lost from spirituality, becomes disconnected from Ruchnius, becomes disconnected from the whole program, and becomes distant from being connected to HaKadosh Baruch. So much so, that these are neshamas, these are souls that it appears that there's no hope. It appears that they're completely lost, and they're trapped in the forces of impurity, the forces of klipa, and there doesn't seem to be any hope for them. So he brings, he says, this is the pshat, what happened over here. What happened over here was that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't account for a certain amount of shkolim, a certain amount of silver he couldn't account for. Why? The Mishkan represents, the Mishkan is a model, the Mishkan represents Klal Yisrael. Right? The Mishkan is the makeup of Klal Yisrael. The Mishkan is the makeup of the Jewish people. Suddenly, Moshe Rabbeinu is building a Mishkan, and he says, the neshamas he can't find. The neshamas he can't connect to. There's missing silver coins. He doesn't know what they're used for. He doesn't know where they went. This is the pshat in the Medrash, that Moshe Rabbeinu forgot what 1,775 shekel of silver was used for. They represent the neshamas that get lost. And they don't seem to be part of the Mishkan. They don't seem to be part of the structure of the Mishkan, which means they don't seem to be part of Klal Yisrael. Until, says the Megala Amuka, he has a vision, Moshe Rabbeinu has a vision of Rabbi Akiva. Why Rabbi Akiva? Because Rabbi Akiva is the one who's able even to reach those neshamas. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, no, the neshamas are not lost. They might be on the periphery, they might be on the outside, but they're not lost. They're part of the Mishkan. Where are they? You don't see them. They're the hooks of the Mishkan. What are the hooks? The hooks are in the outskirts of the Mishkan, just outside the chatzer, just outside the courtyard. And that's what the pasuk means, that Moshe Rabbeinu suddenly realizes, oh, that's where they went. These neshamas, they went to the vavim la'amud, they went to the hooks of the amud, and those hooks are in the outskirts of the Mishkan, just outside the chatzer, just outside the courtyard. But they're still part of the Mishkan. They might be on the outside, but they're still part of the Mishkan, and therefore can be made to be part of the Mishkan. They can be made to be brought back to the Mishkan. But Moshe Rabbeinu can't do that on his own. Moshe Rabbeinu can only do that with Rabbi Akiva's help. The Rabbi Akiva could come and could reveal to him that even those neshamas that are outside the Yud Bei Shvatim, that seem to be outside the 12 tribes, but they're still connected to Klal Yisrael. Why? Because they still have a neshama. And explains, this is a concept which we find in Kabbalah, that we say the 12 tribes are hinted in the name of Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, right? And they've got 12 interpretations. But we know there's a concept of, there's a fifth, Yud Kei Vav Kei is 4 letters. But there's something we call the Kutsoi Shel Yud, the tip of the Yud. Tip of the Yud means there's a 13th level. There's like something outside of the 12. That if you reveal a very deep connection of a Yid and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then that's even present by the Yid that seems to be completely disconnected. In other words, you have to dig very, very deep into the soul of a Yid to discover that even the Yid that seems to be outside of the Yud Kei Vav Kei, seems to be outside of the 12 permutations of Shem Hashem, but there's the Kutsei Shel Yud, there's the tip of the Yud where they're always still connected. And he says an amazing thing. You know, we have the concept that every time we're in trouble, Yom Kippur, fast days, we do tshuva, what do we say? The famous formula that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to teach the Yidden to say, it's called the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy. Why does Hashem have 13 attributes of mercy? What's the cheshon of 13? That's the cheshon. The cheshon is, what's Rachamim? Rachamim means that when you get to a level where there seems to be no hope, suddenly there's a deeper and higher level that becomes revealed and has Rachamim, has mercy and compassion, even if someone has fallen so low. That's the point of Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim. That when the Yidden sinned with the Egel Azov and they did such a terrible thing and they seem to be completely lost, the whole connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, but if you call out to me with the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy, you'll be saved. Why 13? That's the pshat. The structure normally of Klal Yisrael lies in the number 12. But there is a 13th level also, the kutzah shel yud, the tip of the yud, the very depth of the connection between the yud and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to bring it out, and that brings out the 13th attributes of mercy, and that's the yud gimel midas rachmim, the 13th level. The hidden level, the hidden level. That's why he says like this, that Moshe Rabbeinu realized he couldn't find this, but Rabbi Akiva showed him how. Because Rabbi Akiva can descend even in the heel, even to those neshamas that are completely lost. And that's why we find that these hooks are called vavim. An interesting thing. There's two ways we find in the way we spell the letters. There's two ways to spell the letter vav. Vav vav, or vav aleph vav. So the normal way of spelling it is vav vav. It's 12. But the Moshe Rabbeinu realized they made with this extra kesef, they made the hooks, the vavim for the pillars. Why? Because the vav vav has a hidden aleph. There's an aleph in the vav that's hidden. We don't pronounce it, we don't see it always, but that's the hidden 13th level where even those neshamas can reattach themselves and come back into the fold of Klal Yisrael. Then he adds an amazing thing which is relevant to this year, and that's got to do with the whole concept of Purim. And that's really the power of Purim. We know what one of the greatest ideas of Purim is, that Purim is that yontif which reveals the ultimate connection between a Yid and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We know it says in many places, now's the time to go into, maybe we'll do a Purim shiur, we'll go into it more, but Purim is the whole idea that no matter where a Yid is, that even in the time where it was the worst time in Klal Yisrael, where there was a gzeirah to destroy the entire Klal Yisrael with one shot, and there was Haman, and Yidin were in Golos, and Hashem's name is hidden, and it's not apparent, and there was no open miracles, everything was hidden before the miracle, after the miracle, it was all one big darkness, one big Golos, the connection to Hashem can still be revealed. That's the power of Purim. The power of Purim is to find the connection to Hashem even where it's completely hidden. That's the power of Purim. Why is that so connected to this concept? Because he says, that's the concept of an Ibriyar. That's the concept of a leap year. The power of a leap year. In this year, of course, we have a leap year and Purim is a leap year. Why is it the power of the leap year? Because normally, Bichlal, we have what's called the Yud Beis Chodesh, 12 months. The 12 months correspond to the 12 Shvatim, as we know. Each in Kabbalah, it says each month refers to one permutation of the Shem Hashem, and each month corresponds to one Shevet, one of the tribes. But then those neshamas are left out of the tribes. Those lost souls seem to be completely detached. Where do they come into it? Where do they reconnect? That's the power of a leap year, the 13th month. The power of the leap year is the 13th month, extra Chodesh Adar, which is the month where we put Purim. Right? That's the month where we put Purim. And that's where the 13th month is. So when you have Purim in a leap year, this concept is even more emphasized that at the end of the day, no Yid is lost. Every Yid has a connection. Even if temporarily the Yid seems to be out of the fold of Yud Beis Chodesh, of the number 12, there's a 13th month, there's Purim, there's Rabbi Akiva, there's the Akev, that even that can be reconnected. It might have been hidden from Moshe Rabbeinu temporarily, but when you have the Gilu, when you have the revelation of the Neshama Rabbi Akiva, who has the power to take Moshe Rabbeinu's holiness and bring it down to Akev, bring it down to the heel, then you reveal even the connection of those neshamas, and that's when those neshamas reconnect, and that's also the power of Purim. So that's the depth behind that whole story of the audit that Moshe Rabbeinu did, the part of the silver that was missing, and how it was discovered, but discovered through the vision of Rabbi Akiva. Now this concept, actually then, we'll see, is connected to another idea. And let's go back to the beginning of the parasha where we mentioned before we have the word Mishkan twice. What's a deep idea of the Mishkan twice? So let me go back to something interesting. We know that there's a very interesting question with regard to the whole Mishkan, and this will sort of complete the whole life, the journey of the Mishkan. We know that there's a big inconsistency to what gets detail in the Torah. Right? Because Bichlal, generally we know that the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, is very brief. And the oral Torah is much more lengthy. The written Torah is so brief that sometimes we have volumes and volumes of halachas that are mentioned in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch that are learnt out from one word in the Torah, right? A typical example is something we mentioned last week. Shabbos. You know, the laws of Shabbos take up an amazing amount of space in Gemara, in commentary, in Shulchan Aruch, and so on and so forth, right? The whole Shabbos is a few psukim in the Torah, and all the details of the 39 malachas are one or two psukim in the Torah, and it's hinted in a couple of words, and from there we find the whole thing. And it's volumes and volumes of Torah Shabbat. Yet when it comes to the Mishkan, for example, we find a strange thing. We find incredible detail around one of the Mishkan, which we understand, all the halachas of how the Mishkan had to be built, the details, the donations, the materials, and so on and so forth, which are all outlined in great detail in Truma, Tetzaveh, and the beginning of Kisisa. And then we go through the whole thing again in Vayakal Pekudei. A strange thing. Here we have a Torah that's so careful about how it uses its letters that will leave us to work out and to struggle with volumes of halachas from one nuance in the Torah Shebichsav. But yet the Mishkan is all repeated, the whole thing. Repeated, the whole thing, lock, stock, and barrel, all again. All Vayakal Pekudei needed to do was that Moshe Rabbeinu should have gathered the Jewish people, told them the Mishkan, and they all did Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe. That's all we need to know. And they did exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu was commanded by Hashem, and we would know exactly what that is, because we'll have to go back to Truman Tetzav and have a look. And yet the whole thing is repeated. Why? So one of the explanations is that when things are repeated in the Torah, it's because even though they seem identical, but they actually represent different things. I'll give you an example. One of the times we find this also is in Parshas Nosei, later on in the Torah. You know when they inaugurated the Mishkan? So it says when they dedicated the new Mizbeach, so each tribe, for the first 12 days of Nisan, each tribe brought sacrifices, yeah, to in honor of the dedication of the Mishkan. And we read them. It's written out 12 times. And it's very fascinating how it says, on the first day, Nachshon and Aminadav, and it says exactly what his korban was. The second day it was someone else, Nesan al-Ben Sur, and exactly what his korban was. And all the details, he brought cattle and wagons and a whole bunch of things. Third day, fourth day, if you ever look, they're all exactly the same. It's not like they brought different sacrifices, they're exactly the same. And yet the Torah repeats each one separately. Also one of the strange things. Right? And one of the answers I've given is because although they seem the same, but in fact they were completely different. Every leader of every tribe brought a different korban. Every korban meant something different. Every korban introduced into the world a different energy, a different kedusha, a different holiness, a different hamshacha. Right? And therefore the Torah teaches us that by emphasizing the fact that although they seem exactly identical, but the Torah repeats them all 12 times one after another because they were completely different. The same thing with the Mishkan. The Mishkan seems to be repeated twice in the Torah. But it's actually not repeated. Why? Because there are two Mishkans, as we said before. There's the spiritual Mishkan and then there's the physical Mishkan. The Mishkan that was said to Moshe Rabbeinu is a different Mishkan that was said in Vayakal Pekudei. Right? The Mishkan that was communicated to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai was Hashem communicating the Mishkan to Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the greatest prophet. Where was Moshe Rabbeinu at the time? He was on the mountain in a completely spiritual reality. We didn't drink and eat for 40 days. That's one Mishkan. That's one type of Mishkan. A Mishkan is not just a Mishkan. A Mishkan is a model. A Mishkan is building an environment to house Hashem. The Mishkan in Truma Tetzaveh is a spiritual Mishkan. It's a Mishkan, a different kind of Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down to the Bnei Yisrael and he says, I've got to communicate to you to build a Mishkan, but I'm going to tell you about a different Mishkan. The words sound the same, but it's a different Mishkan. It's a Mishkan that you have to build in this world. It's a Mishkan you have to build with physical material. It's a Mishkan you have to build to house Hashem and to bring God into the physical world. To bring it even into the hooks outside the Azor, as we said before, right? It's a Mishkan you got to do to discover within yourself the lowest forms of your reality and make them part of Hashem. Make them part of the spiritual service. Make every part of your life, not just the spiritual part, make every part of who you are a keli, a vessel to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? The Yerushalmi makes reference to this in a very cryptic way and calls it Mishkan Rishon and Mishkan Sheni. He calls it the first Mishkan and the second Mishkan. In other words, this is part of what is hinted in the first pasuk of our parsha, where it says, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, Mishkan HaEdus. Right? These are the audits of the Mishkan of testimony. It mentions the word Mishkan twice. Why? The Mishkan twice is a reference to two types of Mishkan. There's two types of Mishkans, Bechlal, even for us. There's a spiritual Mishkan, where you connect to Hashem in an environment where He's obvious. There's a Mishkan, where you bring Hashem into a place where He's not obvious. What's interesting is, that second Mishkan is called Mishkan HaEdus. Mishkan of testimony, right? What's the definition of the word testimony? In halacha, we find this concept that a witness, what is a witness for? The Gemara will always say that something that is open and obvious, you don't need witnesses for. Right? For example, I'll tell you an interesting halacha. There's a halacha that, you know, in ancient times, in the temple times, when they would make Rosh Chodesh, they would wait for the witnesses to come and say they saw the new moon. Right? The Gemara says, what happens if the Beis Din was sitting and it was a clear sky the night before, the moon was in clear vision, and the whole Beis Din saw the moon? Right? Do they still need to wait the next morning for witnesses? The Gemara, no, they don't have to. Even though normally we know judges cannot be witnesses, but here it's different. They just need to know the moon is there. Something is obvious you don't need a witness for. The purpose of a witness is to testify something that no one knows about. Is to reveal something that is, by definition, a secret. Correct? That's what testimony means. No one calls witnesses for something that is glaringly obvious. You don't need witnesses for that. The whole point of a witness is to reveal something that no one knows about. That's why the second Mishkan is called Mishkan HaEdus. There's two Mishkans. There's a spiritual Mishkan, which is the Mishkan talked about in Trumot HaTzaveh, where we connect to Hashem, where it's very obvious. We're involved in the things of Kedusha, learning, davening, and so on and so forth. But that's not the Mishkan of a Yaakov Pekudei. The Mishkan of a Yaakov Pekudei is what the Torah says, the second Mishkan, Mishkan HaEdus. It's the Mishkan of testimony. It's the Mishkan where you reveal that which is hidden, where you reveal Hashem where He's not obvious, where you go into the world of the physical and the mundane and the lowest forms of reality, and that's where you reveal Hashem. That's called Mishkan HaEdus, and that's the Mishkan of the Yaakov Pekudei. And that's related to the vote we said before. That's the point of the Mishkan. The point of the Mishkan ultimately is to bring everyone into the Mishkan, even those neshamas which are so low and on the lowest level, the ones that even Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't find, so to speak. So this idea ties into a fascinating Yerushalmi. There's a Talmud Yerushalmi in the Jerusalem Talmud where it talks about the following concept. It talks about the mitzvah of davening, right? We have to daven every day. So we know that davening, the primary part of davening is the Shemoneh Esrei, the Amidah. And Amidah has 18 brachas. Now we know it's interesting that the Amidah, the Shemoneh Esrei, is the highest point of davening. It's the ultimate connection between Yid and Hashem, right? We're elevating ourselves. We know that the davening is called a ladder. It's a ladder. It's a journey where we elevate ourselves from bottom to up, and we keep going closer and closer to Hashem. When we reach the pinnacle, so to speak, the ultimate, the climax of our connection to Hashem during davening, is when we stand Shemoneh Esrei. That's why we have to stand straight with our feet together, and we connect, we communicate. Interestingly enough, by the way, just on this topic, we know the Shemoneh Esrei is actually not a very spiritual thing. Dafke, at the point of davening where we are, you know, when we talk about Shema, you know, Shema, we talk about love of Hashem, fear of Hashem, the choosing of Am Yisrael, the B'chol Avavcha, B'chol Nashcha, B'chol Lo'edecha, right? Sorry? Yeah, okay, but that's what we're supposed to try and focus, right, at that degree. What's Shemoneh Esrei? What is Shemoneh Esrei about? Shemoneh Esrei, which is the ultimate connection between a Yid and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, wealth, curing the sick, giving us what we need, giving us parnasa, right? It's funny, at the highest point of davening, we talk about the lowest forms of who we are. Because truly, that's what davening is all about. Davening is the ultimate connection. The ultimate connection to Hashem is not to connect our love of Hashem and our heart to Hashem only. That's just a preparation. Of course, we've got to have an injection of intense spirituality. The ultimate of connection to Hashem is when you can take everything, your gashmistic things, your mundane requests, and make them part of a connection to Hashem, right? So Yerushalmi says an interesting thing. Yerushalmi says, how do we know that there are 18 brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei? Why was there 18 brachas of Shemoneh Esrei? Okay, it happens to be today they're 19, because Chazal added one in later, because they had tzaddis from the heretics, so they had to add in a separate bracha. Okay. But originally there was 18 brachas. So there's a few different suggestions in the Gemara. 18 times it says Hashem in the a certain chapter of Tehillim, 18 parts of the spine, and so on and so forth. One of the answers that Yerushalmi gives is that there's 18 times in Mishkan Sheni, right, in the second Mishkan, where it says the word Kasher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. And Hashem commanded Moshe. Mishkan Sheni refers to Parshas Pekudei, right? There are 18 times that it says, as Hashem commanded Moshe. Now the Yerushalmi clarifies. and says, I know you're going to go check it up and you're going to count it and you're going to see there's not. There's 19 times. Right? In Parshat Pekudei, the word Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe is 19 times. Says the Yerushalmi, no. Look at the beginning of the Chumash. Where's the first time? The first time is in Pasuk Chav Beis, right? Where we get introduced to Bezalel. Bezalel said he did everything Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu. Then we say, the Itoy with him, Aliyah ben Achisamach, was Aliyah of the son Achisamach, who also helped Bezalel. Then the rest of the parasha, we have many, many times that they both did, Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe. Says the Yerushalmi, we only count the phrase Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe only once Aliyah ben Achisamach is mentioned. That's why there's 18 brachos in the Shemoneh Esrei, because you write it's taken 19 times it says Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe in Parashat Pekudei, but we only count when the 18 times from when Aliyah ben Achisamach is mentioned. The question is why? What Bezalel is no good? Yeah, only Dafka. The answer is like this. First of all, why does the Yerushalmi connect the Mishkan to davening? Because it's the same idea. We know that today we daven instead of bringing korbanos. Why? Because the same idea. What's davening? Davening is to connect ourselves to Hashem, to make ourselves a Mishkan to Hashem. Says the Yerushalmi, when you make a Mishkan, there's two parts of the Mishkan. There's Bezalel and there's Aliyah. You know why they were both involved in the Mishkan? Because Bezalel and Aliyah were two opposite people. Bezalel came from the highest Shevet. Aliyah ben Achisamach came from the lowest Shevet. The Shevet that we mentioned before, which is responsible for the lost neshamas. Those are the ones where the lost neshamas get taken from. Shevet Don. They were the ones that traveled at the end of the journey. It says Yerushalmi, you want to make a Mishkan? The point of the Mishkan is not just to be Bezalel. Bezalel, just to take the strong parts of who you are. Just to take the ruchnistik, the spiritual parts of who you are. The Bezalel part of who you are. And or the Bezalel type of people, and use them to make a Mishkan. Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe, Hashem commanded Moshe. Before you include Aliyah ben Achisamach, that's not going to work. That's not a Mishkan. We don't include that in the Shemoneh Esrei. A Mishkan is only complete when you have Kasher Tziva Hashem is Moshe, when you have Bezalel and Achisamach. Sorry, Aliyah, I mean, and Aliyah ben Achisamach, right? Because Aliyah ben Achisamach, you need Aliyah ben Achisamach lematei don. In order to build a Mishkan, you have to include everything. In order to daven Shemoneh Esrei, you have to include the lowest forms of your existence. You have to include all those things that Aliyah ben Achisamach stands for. You have to include all those neshamas that Aliyah ben Achisamach stands for. And only then is a complete Mishkan. Because ultimately, the whole purpose of the Mishkan is not the Mishkan of Truma Tetzaveh. That's just a preparation. The purpose of the Mishkan is the Mishkan of Yaakov Pekudei. The purpose of the Mishkan is to bring Hashem into the lowest forms of existence, to reveal Hashem where you least expect Him to be found. That's the power of the Mishkan, and that's ultimately why Shemoneh Esrei only is taken once Aliyah ben Achisamach is introduced, which again links back to the whole idea of Purim, which is why Purim is the ultimate connection between Yid and Hashem. You know that the Jewish calendar works from Pesach, right? Pesach is the first Yom Tov. Pesach is the birth of Klal Yisrael. And then another time to go into this. I mean, the calendar is a fascinating cycle. How it works, Pesach and Shavuos and Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, whole story, right? But ultimately, what's the last Yontif? Or the last two Yontifs, actually. The last Yontif is Purim, right? Purim is actually the end of the cycle. Purim is the climax of the connection between Yid and Hashem. Why? Because Purim is the day where we reach the Madrega, where we don't have to be in a Yontif to connect Hashem. We don't have to stop working. Purim is, you allowed to do Melacha. Purim is a rabbinic Yontif. It's not such a holy day, and yet it's higher than Yom Kippur. As the Zohar says, Yom Kippur is called Yom Kippurim, and they like Purim. It's not quite like Purim. Purim is a higher connection. Why? Because Purim is the day where you finally get to the level where you can reveal Hashem everywhere. You can reveal Hashem even in food and drink, even in a day that's a regular day. It's not a Yontif, it's not Yom Kippur, it's not Sukkot. And that's the ultimate connection to Hashem, and that's why it's the ultimate Simcha. And when you finish that, that's the climax of the connection to Hashem, and then the cycle starts again from Pesach. But that's connected to this concept that the Mishkan is only complete when you can include the neshamas from Aliyah ben Achisamach and those type of people, not just Bezalel from the highest Shevet. And that's why the Shemoneh Esrei is taken Dafka once he's mentioned the 18 times for the 18 brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei. Okay.